You're listening to WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
Check, check, one, two. Look like a little country. Rock and roll and blues. Cause we sure love playing for good people like you. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two.
You are listening to Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, the radio show that features conversations with and the music of local musicians and traveling musicians performing in town. I'm your host, Dave Lake. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I'm talking with Dr. Augusta Palmer, director and producer of the film The Blues Society, which will be playing as part of the Hindsight Film Festival on this Saturday, March 7th at 1:30 p.m. in the Ben Tucker Theater of the Otis S. Johnson Cultural Center. This film is about the blues masters and white hippies who put together the Memphis Country Blues Festival in the 1960s, which resonates even still today. Welcome to Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, Augusta Palmer.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm really excited to be showing the film in Savannah, too.
And so let's get to know Augusta Palmer. Tell me your cinematic and musical journeys, which led you to this film.
Well, I have made a few documentaries, and another one significantly is about music, about the master musicians of Jijuka, this Moroccan Sufi band. And like the Blues Society, it also involved my father, who was a music writer for the New York Times. And so I never thought I'd be making another film that involved him. But when I heard about this footage of the Memphis Country Blues Festival that had been really kept in a basement for decades, I just found it irresistible. And I also like that it's very much a collective story. So he's just one mosaic in a big mosaic with lots of component parts.
Tell me how you got involved in filmmaking.
Sure. Well, growing up, I loved visual art and I loved theater. And it really took me until college. I feel like I was a little slow in this respect to go, what's the thing that brings that together? Film. So when I got to college, I started making films and being interested in films and got to watch a lot of films and learn a lot about film history. And then I took a little detour and got a PhD in film history, but I had been making films in college and then kind of got inspired by the subject matter of my PhD dissertation, which is Chinese cinema in the 1990s and all these very scrappy young directors trying to document their quickly changing world. And I thought, wow, I want to be doing that, not just writing about it. So I got back to making films and have been doing that ever since.
And where did you go to school to learn about film?
I went to Sarah Lawrence College for my undergraduate, and for graduate work, I went to New York University, NYU.
And so let's talk about the Memphis Country Blues Festival. It started very informally, my understanding is, in 1966, with a very informal performance at the Overton Park Shell in Memphis.
That's right. I mean, I think it was only a few days in the making, you know, in terms of the planning leading up to it. Jim Dickinson, who is a great musician and producer among many other claims to fame. He played the piano in the Rolling Stones' Wild Horses, but he also produced a ton of records. He had a session check for $65 from a Sun Records release called Cadillac Man. And so it was that check. And Bill Barth, who was another of the major organizers, a guy from the East Coast, who was a huge blues fan and had played with Fahey. They had an act together called Blind Joe Death, but Barth had a baseball-sized chunk of hash. And with that and the $65, they were able to finance and put up the first Memphis Country Blues Festival in 1966.
Well, and how did they get musicians there?
Well, so the hash was payment for the white musicians who mainly were there to benefit the black blues legends who got all the cash that was taken in. And so, I think that there was a lot of enthusiasm among these white young hippie musicians to honor their blues idols. So they wanted to be there. I'm sure that the hash didn't hurt, but I think it was also incredibly generous and trusting of these black blues legends to come and play too, because especially the first time they didn't know whether they'd really get much of anything because they were just taking a dollar admission at the gate. And then those dollar bills were divided up and given to the players. And I think some of them, even the first year, maybe got as much as 500 and maybe more for playing. And so that was in a time when some of them did not have much income coming in. So it was really significant. I mean, that was a lot more money then than it is now. But yeah. But they didn't, of course, have that guarantee the first year going in, or any idea what these crazy hippies were up to. But they were willing to take a chance on it.
Well, those who are familiar with the history of the blues will recognize names like Furry Lewis and Reverend Robert Wilkins. I'm not sure today their names are resonant as they should be.
Yeah, I think that sadly is true. And that's, one of the reasons why I really wanted to make the film. I mean, Furry Lewis is just this consummate performer. I'm happy I've been putting some little snippets of him up on TikTok and people are liking it there. I mean, he started out, he had a recording contract, like a lot of the musicians featured in the Memphis Country Blues Festival. He had a recording contract in the 20s and 30s. But blues really stopped being re recorded nearly as much, even as of the Depression. So, and but then there was kind of a revival in like 59. Samuel Charters published this book, The Country Blues, and Furry was featured in it. But Furry had also been a medicine show performer. So I just feel like he could enchant any audience, whether it was an audience of three or an audience of 3,000. And he eventually got to, I think it's in 1978, got to open for the Rolling Stones when they played in Memphis. And the Stones were very happy to have him do that. So he could enchant that stadium audience too. And Robert Gordon, who has a great filmmaker and historian of Memphis and of music, went to that show, and that's how he kind of fell in love with Furry Lewis in 1978 at the Rolling Stone show.
Don't you wish your good girl was long and tall like mine? Don't you wish your good girl was long and tall like mine? Lord, she ain't good looking, but I class she takes her time. Then my good girl says she didn't want me no more. Oh, my good girl says she didn't want me no more. But she's on my Daniel, Lord, everywhere I go. Lord, the train I ride is 16 coaches long. Train I ride is 16 coaches long. And she don't hold nothing but chocolate to the bone. I'm worried now, I've been worried all day long. I'm worried now, I've been worried all day long. Baby, I won't be worried until the day I'm gone. Lord, it's some say yellow, but give my black and brown. Lord, some say yellow, but give my black and brown. When your high brown quit, your black will run you down. I wanna see a girl I'm so crazy about. Wanna see that girl I'm so crazy about. I'd be so glad, I sure can't help for a shout.
So Robert Wilkins has a more direct connection to the Rolling Stones because they recorded his song Prodigal Son and initially said it was a Jagger and Richards composition when it was released on Beggar's Banquet. I mean, there were a lot of people who were pretty shocked and appalled by that, and among them, the organizers of the blues festivals.
The Prodigal Son left home, a strange land. And he become to get destitute and hungry and weary. Then he came to himself. So I believe I'll go back home and acknowledge to my father that I did wrong. The last word I might not heard him say, the last word I might not heard him say, the last word I might not heard him say, and that's no way for me to get along. Say I'm going to my father, give me all of mine today, all of tell my father, give me all of mine today. Going to tell my father, give me all of mine today. And the poor boy got all he had. He started on down the road, started on down the road. He got all he had, he started on. All he had is starting on down the road, and that's the way for me to get along. Said I'm going somewhere out in this world, and God never to know it, God never to know it. Going somewhere out in this world, and God never to know it. Going somewhere out in this world, and God never to know it. And the poor boy got away from home and spent all that he had, spent all that he had. Got away from home and spent all that he had. Got away from home and spent all that he had. And that was no way for him to get along. Spent all he had, and a famine come in the land, a famine come. Spent all he had, no fame had come in the land. Spent all he had, no fame had come in the land. And that was no way for him to get along. I believe I'm going high, myself to some Maine, myself to some Maine. Believe I'm going high, myself to some Maine. Yeah, I'm going high, myself to some Maine. And that'd be the way for me to get along. And the Maine
praying to my give you a job, born to feed my swine, born to feed my swine. I'll give you a job, born to feed my swine. I give you a job, boy, to feed my swine. And that'd be the way for you to get along. And the poor boy stood there and he hung his head and cried, hung his head and cried. The poor boy stood there and he hung his head and cried. The poor boy stood there and he hung his head and cried. Said I believe I'll rise, I believe I'll go back home, believe I'll go back home. I believe I'll rise, I believe I'll go back home. Believe I'll rise, I believe I'll go back home. And that'll be the way for me to get along. And it's far down the road, friend, and it's far to see, and it's far to see. Far down the road, friend, and it's far to see. Far down the road, friend, and it's far to see. Said I believe that my son coming home to me, coming home to me. I believe that's my son coming home to me. Believe that's my son coming home to me. That's the way for us to get along. And his father run to him and fell down on his knee, fell down on his knee. His father run to him and fell down on his knee. His father run to him and fell down on his knee. Begin to sing and pray. Lord, have mercy on me, Lord, have mercy on me. Gonna sing and pray, Lord, have mercy on me. Gonna sing and pray, Lord, have mercy on me. And I'm so glad the Lord sent my son home to me, my son home to me. So glad the Lord sent my son home to me. The Lord sent my son home for me. Let us all eat it, drink, and we all feed
us all eat and drink, we all be merry and glad. All eat and drink, we all be merry and glad. And that'll be the way for us to get along.
The Rolling Stones did actually offer to come to Memphis and play in order to raise more money for people like Furry and Robert Wilkins. But the city of Memphis were kind of afraid of that. I mean, and I guess it is worth remembering Altamont hadn't happened yet, but it happened that same year. So I don't know. It could have been pretty chaotic to have the Rolling Stones play at Overton Park, but it also could have been pretty great.
Of course, this started in 1966, and the late 60s was a very tumultuous time in Memphis and throughout the South.
Throughout America, really. You know, there's a great writer, Mark Kurlansky, who has a book that's called 1968, and it sets its sights outside of the United States, but it's just was shocking to me when I was doing research for the film to read that book and just read about everything that was happening in 1968 alone. I mean, you know, the assassination of Martin Luther King, all these huge demonstrations in France, just all over the world. It was a pretty tumultuous time, but especially in the United States. Yes. And maybe even especially in Memphis.
Well, as you can tell from the grayness, I'm chronologically challenged. And so I grew up in the 60s, and to me, blues was forever, because the 60s was really when blues reignited as a real art form across the country.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. And then, you know, rock and roll is definitely a direct descendant of the blues. So I think that the organizers of the Memphis Country Blues Festival, you know, that they really wanted to make sure that the originators of the music got some of their due, people like Furry Lewis and Booker White and Reverend Robert Wilkins, who were getting recognition, and there were blues festivals forming around the country. I think the Berkeley Blues Festival was maybe 65, so had a little bit of a jump, 1 year jump on the Memphis Country Blues Festival, but it was definitely gaining in popularity. And Memphis had been such a center for blues recording and for blues musicians. So I think there was also blues fans from around the country were pretty excited to come to Memphis and hear blues in its natural habitat, so to speak.
And to me, I mean, again, coming to age in the 60s, blues can hardly be spoken without Memphis in the same sentence.
Yeah, it's really true. And I think that that's a pretty natural thing given Memphis's location. Of course, there was tons of blues that was happening south of Memphis, but Memphis was maybe one of the first stops that people made on the train trip on that great migration where people were going to Chicago and some were heading off to New York and some were even going to California. But a lot of those people, if they were coming from southern Arkansas, southern Mississippi, they were going through Memphis, and there were big audiences for the music there, and all kinds of record companies in the 20s and 30s were coming there and recording on the roof of the Peabody Hotel and different places in Memphis. And there were some record scouts who were going out further into the country in Arkansas and in Mississippi, to some extent in Tennessee. But for the most part, that was just a great, great place to find blues music and for blues musicians to live.
And of course, you say coming from the South, and by that you mean the Mississippi Delta.
Yes, exactly. The Mississippi Delta, for sure. Yeah. Which is a very, very rich producer of music and culture, and still is.
This is WRUULP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings Community Radio with Global Soul.
You're listening to WRUU, your local radio station, for people just like you, hosted by people from your community. The voices you hear are your neighbors, coworkers, and others from the Savannah and Lowcountry area. In other words, WRUU is your community radio station. Please help us by donating whatever you can to help your neighbors and friends stay on the air. Go to WRUU.org and support your local radio station. Any amount is welcomed. Thank you for your support of WRUU.
This portion of WRUU's programming is brought to you by listeners like you and by the 2026 Savannah Music Festival, which runs from March 25th through April 5th. American Roots Music programming will feature Mike Marshall and Alessandro Panazzi, Sierra Hall and John Craigie, Old Crow Medicine Show, Daryl Scott featuring Rob Ickes, and more. More information about concerts and tickets can be found at www.savannahmusicfestival.org. The Savannah Philharmonic's Music of Empire Elgar's Enigma concert with the guest conductor Benjamin Manis is on Saturday, March 28th at 7:30 p.m. in the Lucas Theater for the Arts and features, in addition to Elgar's Enigma variations, the violist Philip Dukes performing Vaughan Williams' Flos Campi with the Savannah Philharmonic Chorus. More information and tickets are available at savannahphilharmonic.org. This music is often called classical music, but remember, Mozart, Beethoven, and Liszt were the rock stars of their time, so I simply call it great music. I'm your host, Dave Lake, and join me for four centuries of great music, with new episodes each week on Sundays from 3 to 5 p.m. We also have encores of these episodes on Saturdays from 3 to 5 p.m. from mid-June to early December. Welcome back to Music Local and Sustainable, and I'm your host, Dave Lake. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I'm talking with Dr. Augusta Palmer, director and producer of the film The Blues Society, which will be playing as part of the Hindsight Film Festival on this Saturday, March 7th at 1:30 p.m. in the Ben Tucker Theater of the Otis S. Johnson Cultural Center. This film is about the blues masters and white hippies who put together the Memphis Country Blues Festival in the 1960s, which resonates even still today. Well, I have to confess that indeed, although I consider Memphis and blues as synonymous, it was later in life when I was off at college that I got a good friend who's from Chicago, and we spent a lot of time in Chicago with Chicago blues.
Well, yeah, and actually what's kind of funny is that I think I fell in love with the blues in Chicago because I lived there for not quite a year, but a very formative part of my life. I was about 20 years old and going to the Checkerboard Lounge. That was really exciting to me because the music seemed so alive and the crowds were really into it. And before that, I guess I mainly heard just recordings of blues, which were great, which I really enjoyed, but I was seeing it with a live audience. And much later, I was able to do that in Mississippi as well and in Memphis. So that was also really wonderful. But yeah, Chicago is really where my love for the blues really blossomed as well. So I'm not surprised. And Chicago has its own great blues tradition. Although I think the huge divide between country blues and Chicago blues is somewhat overstated. I mean, because these country blues players in Memphis, they definitely have their own unique style. That I'm not discounting. But when people hear country blues, they kind of think it's all going to be acoustic and acoustic guitars and stuff like that. But everybody was playing amplified. Furry Lewis was the only person who was really playing an acoustic guitar with a pickup, you know, but even the very traditional players like Nathan Beauregard, he was playing a Japanese electric guitar. So that influence is just going backwards and forwards all the time, I think, between Chicago and Memphis, Memphis and the Delta, and just traveling back and forth. And I love the blues scholar Elijah Wald said to me at one point, he said, the thing is, people in the country always know what people in the city are doing. People in the city never have any idea what people in the country are doing, which I think he was implying, and that's kind of to city people's detriment. And As somebody who's been living in New York for a long time, I guess I could say he's right on some level.
Yeah, there is the rest of the country outside of New York and Chicago.
Yes.
Now, getting back to the beginning of the Memphis Country Blues Festival, which, by the way, has been reinitiated and is very active with some really great blues players even now. But in the 60s, very tumultuous time, and but it was a time to bring black and white music lovers together. It's one thing about the blues that was so valuable, I think, at that time.
Yeah. And, that was, I think when I started making the Blues Society, it took me a while. So I was starting in earnest in 2016. And I remember talking to the management of the Overton Park Shell, which is where the festivals took place in the 60s, and saying it was so amazing that they had these integrated audiences, white and black audiences at the Blues Festival. And one of the people who worked there said, yeah, I find that it's difficult to do that even now. I think the Overton Park Shell current leadership has done a really amazing job of making that happen much more frequently in the last like 5 or 6 years. But yeah, I mean, I think American society is still not nearly as integrated as I would like it to be. And it was certainly much more challenging then to do that. I mean, when they started the festival in 1966, the staff bathrooms at the band shell were still segregated. There were still white and black bathrooms for staff. So that's, kind of a marker for just as a reminder of how segregated society still was.
And we've mentioned Furry Lewis and Reverend Robert Wilkins. You mentioned Booker White, which is short for Booker T. Washington White.
Yes.
But Booker White. But there are some other really fabulous musicians there. Mississippi Fred McDowell was at the 66.
Incredible. Yeah. He was at every one of the blues festivals. So yeah, Mississippi Fred McDowell was just this incredible player and beloved by so many, and could really turn on a dime between kind of like playing a spiritual and playing a blues song, and just had this really unique, beautiful style of playing guitar. I mean, I think like once you've heard him and you know it's him, like you can recognize him playing, and definitely was a huge influence on lots of players as well, white and black, that came after him.
I have a care of mine. my troubles. I haven't
He worked at a gas station in Mississippi and also was a sharecropper. So I believe that the writer Stanley Booth had asked Fred McDowell in the 60s how much he was making on his farm. And it was something like under $75 a year. So I guess he was making more than that at Stuckey's, the gas station. I sure hope so. But so making maybe $1,000 at some of these blues festivals was pretty significant for him. But he had also played at Newport the editor of the Blues Society. It was the editor of a great new film by Robert Gordon about the Newport Folk Festival. So, yeah, so there was, a convergence of interest in people who like folk music and people who like blues music. But folk music festivals took off just a little bit sooner, a few years sooner than blues festivals. And there's some contention there too, because I think that a lot of people define something as folk music sort of meant that it was like museumified. It came from the past. And a lot of people who love the blues were saying, you know, this is very living music. Well, I think there are people who would argue on both sides of that, and they have some validity to their points. And I think also some blues fans, you know, felt that the blues was so important as an art form that it really deserved to be treated with the same kind of seriousness that, say, classical music was treated with. And that was another big thing about having this blues festival in a public bandshell, because that bandshell had really been for mainly for symphonic music. Elvis had played there too. But it had mainly been for symphonic music and for music that people thought was edifying or truly great. And that sadly wouldn't have been the way that a lot of people locally thought about blues music. They put it down a lot. They didn't realize the treasure that they had, as James Alexander from the Barcade says early in the film, that Memphis has this jewel, but people don't really appreciate it, which I think has often been true.
Well, you mentioned Mississippi Fred McDowell. He could turn from song to song, from spirituals to the blues and back again. And there's just been a very large number of shows that I've been doing on one of my sister programs here at WRU, and that's Evening Eclectic on spirituals. And just about everybody I've talked to talking about spirituals has pointed out how influential the blues was in terms of the modern spiritual. You know, traditional mm-hmm. spiritual, of course, comes from the period of slavery in the South, but the modern spiritual was so influenced by blues as well. And in rock and roll, in rhythm and blues, in modern gospel, you cannot underappreciate or you cannot underattribute the influences of blues and spirituals as the roots of all of that music.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's complex. There's a great scholar of African-American music named Portia Maltsby, who has a very complicated chart. And I'm sure you can Google Portia Maltsby African-American music chart about the relationship. Because like the rural-urban divide that sometimes gets, you know, narrated as being absolute or clear, I think that there's just a lot of travel back and forth between those traditions. I recently saw a great film called Say Amen, Somebody, which is a great film about gospel music. And yeah, I mean, I feel like so much of the performance style and sometimes the guitar playing, this kind of call and response aspect that's in blues and spirituals and gospel, right? They have a lot that they share. And a lot of that, many people have traced back that it has West African roots, of course. But then it also kind of merged together, or people were playing that and playing sort of Scots and Irish folk music. So that combination in Sinners, the movie, is not accidental. Like musically, those musics came together and that music brought something to blues too. But yeah, I think that all of American music owes a huge debt to the people who were enslaved, who brought African music here and then transformed it in a new environment, but kept their traditions there too.
Tonight on Savannah Music, Local and Sustainable, I'm talking with Dr. Augusta Palmer, director and producer of the film, The Blues Society. Well, and I should have mentioned jazz when I mentioned the music from which the roots of blues is really rich, because you can hardly go through a jazz album without a richness of blues coming out. And now you're seeing so much expansion of jazz, or the connection of jazz into Latin music, as well as Caribbean, Afro-Cuban music, yeah. African roots in jazz from a variety.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Well, the jazz pianist Randy Weston was a friend of mine, and I remember him explaining from his point of view to me what the blues was, that it's very primal, because it's all it's about is, I love you, baby. And the other person says, yeah, but I don't love you back. So we've all gone through that at one time or another. So that is one root of the blues, but it's also, I think that, I remember him saying to me, it's also like the sounds of nature and the sounds of humans coming together to celebrate or to mourn. It has some deep roots, but jazz definitely really took a lot of blues notes and blues tendencies and expanded upon them and made its own idiom. And then I think that rap music is drawing on all those traditions too now. So yeah, it's a big bouillabaisse of a lot of delicious things mixed together that make American music, but certainly blues is pretty deep there at the roots.
One of the great misconceptions of the blues, it was illustrated in a comment that was made in the film about whites as well as blacks can feel melancholy, and so whites as well as blacks can sing the blues. But there's so much more to the blues. I mean, there's a laugh out loud humor to the blues.
Yeah, well, I think Jamie Hatley, who is a great writer from Memphis and now also a filmmaker, she talks about the fact that blues is putting the joy and the survival on record. And in 2016, when I interviewed her, she said, we need that right now. And that's still true. We still need that, maybe even more so. So, yeah, of course, I think that is a misconception about the blues, that it's sorrowful. And of course, there is some real deep sorrow and suffering being expressed in the blues, but much of the time, it's taking that sorrow and making it into something that gets you through the night. Joy and sexuality and all those things are a big part of making that happen and making life worthwhile. So yeah, the blues definitely, it really does dig down deep into the real pain and difficulty of human experience, but it does that to come up and grow something new and joyful and beautiful.
Well, the 66th Memphis County Blues Festival was the beginning. It was a tumultuous time, as we were talking about. And in fact, you have reference to a Ku Klux Klan leader in Memphis at that time.
Yeah, there was a Klan rally in Overton Park just a few days before the festival. I don't get into the film that apparently there were a lot of people there at the Klan rally heckling the Klans. And also, the city of Memphis actually changed some of their regulations for applying for the ability to gather in public spaces so that the Klan couldn't gather in the park again. I mean, they did that in 66 already. So it's not as if, everyone was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, obviously. But yes, I mean, it was a br really brutal time. It was still really a time when older white people expected if they were walking down the street that a black person would get off the sidewalk and let them pass. And that doesn't even get at the kind of violence that was happening to black people in Memphis and around the country at that time. And sadly, some of it's still happening now, or now we're also seeing it happen to immigrants. So yes, definitely, I think white supremacy is something that the film is about to a certain extent, and how to grapple with that, because we're still grappling with it. It's part of our history as Americans. I wish it wasn't, but it is. And so I think we have to talk about it, in my opinion. I mean, that I there definitely are still people who, on social media, sometimes I hear people saying, why are you talking about, I don't know, social issues when you're made this film about the blues? You should only talk about music. But Most music, I think, is actually inherently political. Even the classical music, in its context, when it came out, much of it was thought of as quite political. Beethoven was political in a certain sense because it was displaying all this emotion that people found shocking at the time, just for example. So yes, I mean that's and how Americans didn't value blues tradition for a long time and thought about it as this lesser thing and not something to be immensely proud of, which I think we all should be really proud of this cultural legacy that this incredible music of joy and survival, as we were talking about before. So yeah, that's definitely something that the film is grappling with. And even with the white blues fans who put on the festival and really so admired people like Furry Lewis and Fred McDowell and Robert Wilkins and Nathan Beauregard. The cultures were so different. I think it was really almost impossible for them to really communicate in an easy way or an unfettered way. And a lot of that was the power dynamic. So that Nathan Beauregard was this great player, and unlike many of the other players featured at the festival, he had never had a recording career, and he had been blind for a lot of his life, and kind of dependent on family and friends. And he was discovered, quote, which is, I always have to put that in air quotes because he'd been around the whole time. But anyway, Bill Barth heard him playing and decided to have him come and play at the blues festivals. And from that, he did get to make some records and things like that.
Well, you just can't tell now. Was on a sweet woman mine. Well, you can't tell what's on a woman's mind. When you think she loving you, yeah, she putting you down.
of Bill Barth heard Nathan Beauregard's repertoire, and from his repertoire decided that he was, you know, over 100 years old, but he was only 70, but he was quickly being billed as like the world's oldest living blues man, and he was making some money. So how could he come and say, like, I'm sorry, guys, but I'm only in my 70s. Instead, he said, thank you, I will take that cash that you're offering me in the brown paper bag that you collected from people. And when people would ask him his age, he was kind of canny about it and wouldn't say. So there's a sense in which he was playing along, but it's also, I think the organizers didn't think of themselves as having power and having white privilege. That wasn't even something that people named in that way at that time. So that's an important part of the film too, is trying to understand that relationship and not cast aspersions on anybody, but just to think about how can we move forward as a culture and have a culture where we're honestly exchanging across generational and racial lines.
We've been talking about the 1966 festival, but the 1969 festival, after the assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968, was also a critical time for blues, for America, and for music at that time.
Yes, and it was also this kind of immense growth of that festival from the very informal beginnings that we started with, you know, with this ball of hash and a $65 check and a one-day festival. By 1969, it became a three-day festival, and the city of Memphis was involved, but they wanted to have some good publicity for the city, and I think these blues festivals definitely played a big role in Memphis deciding that blues was part of their tourism brand, which is still in play today. But it was also a great festival with lots of great players and big audiences. And Johnny Winter played. That was actually an act that the city of Memphis wanted to bring on. Johnny Winter was a great player, but a Texas blues player, not a Memphis player. And he had this kind of wall of giant amps, which was, even if I'm saying that the country blues was mainly amplified, it wasn't amplified at that level. So, and then because he had a bigger name and had just signed a big recording contract, people beat down the fence to try and get in and weren't paying for their tickets, their $1 tickets. So there's a person who makes an impassioned speech about that, who actually is my mother, which is how I got involved really in making the film, is that I was shocked to hear the voice of my mother when she was pregnant with me making that speech. It seemed quite familiar in some weird way.
So we really needed to go back even further with you and your love of blues in college.
Yes. It's a little fuzzy for me. But many of the people who were older than me that were there, it was fuzzy for them too, for different reasons. But yes, so that's one of the things that was very cool to me, that when I realized in a strange way, I had been there at the 69 Blues Festival.
So tonight on Savannah Music, Local and Sustainable, I've been talking with Dr. Augusta Palmer, director and producer of the film The Blues Society, which will be playing as part of the Hindsight Film Festival on this Saturday, March 7th, at 1:30 p.m. at the Ben Tucker Theater of the Otis S. Johnson Cultural Center. And this film, again, as we've been talking about, is about the Memphis County Blues Festival, particularly in the 60s, and that still is occurring today in Memphis. And come out, because you'll be able to see in person Dr. Augusta Palmer. So I want to thank you so very much, Augusta Palmer, for being on the show tonight.
Thank you, Dave. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
This has been another edition of Music Local and Sustainable, and I've been your host, Dave Lake. Save this time for another show next week.
Well, I know we ain't headed for the Hall of Fame. Gonna give it what we got, man, it ain't no shame. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, 1, 2. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, 1, 2.